AI has not been unambiguously good. It has raised challenges and complications.
None of this is inevitable. OpenAI and Anthropic and DeepSeek would like us to believe this is inevitable. It's not inevitable. The technologies that we choose to bring into schools are our choices.
Hey friends, welcome back to Think Inclusive, real conversations about building schools where every learner belongs. I'm your host, Tim Villegas. Today's episode is about how generative AI is showing up in classrooms and what that actually means for educators who are trying to balance access, integrity, and inclusion. This conversation digs into the messy middle, the hopes, the headaches, and the big questions about what helps students learn versus what simply feels new. Our guests today are Justin Reich, Associate Professor of Digital Media in the Comparative Media Studies Writing Department at MIT, Director of the Teaching Systems Lab, longtime educator and host of the Teach Lab podcast, as well as Jesse Dukes, journalist, comedian, and veteran audio storyteller working with MIT's Teaching Systems Lab on the Homework Machine project. We talk about why AI has landed unevenly in schools, how teachers are experimenting to support students with different needs, and why listening closely to classroom voices matters more than rushing toward the next shiny framework. They also share what they're learning from hundreds of students and teachers trying to figure out when AI supports learning and when it gets in the way. And here's something fun to look forward to. You'll hear how a real harpsichord ended up in the production of The Homework Machine. Before we meet our guests, I want to tell you about our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by IXL. IXL is an all-in-one platform for K-12 that helps boost student achievement, empowers teachers, and tracks progress in one place. As students practice, IXL adapts to their individual needs so that every learner gets just right support and challenge. And each student gets a personalized learning plan to close gaps. Check it out at IXL.com/inclusive. Again, that's IXL.com/inclusive. All right, after a quick break, it's time to think inclusive with Justin Reich and Jesse Dukes. Catch you on the other side. Jesse Dukes and Justin Reich, welcome to the Think Inclusive podcast. Really excited for this conversation.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Thanks for having us, Tim.
All right. So you're here because of the limited series podcast that you have called The Homework Machine. And I just want to say up front, it is fantastic. And I am, I think in the, I don't know, five episodes in and out of a seven, I can't exactly remember, but I think it busted was the last one that I listened to.
That's my recent episode. It might be my favorite episode.
It is really good. It is really good. And I really appreciate the storytelling and how relevant it is to our audience. And I feel like the podcast was written for me. You know, like, I think I am your audience.
Good. I'm glad
we didn't know you when we were writing the scripts, but I'm glad it feels that way.
I think this would be a good one for Tim.
Oh, thanks, guys. and I think that, how our audience and how I listen to it may be a little bit different than maybe what you were looking for as far as audience goes is the people that listen to Think Inclusive are really like laser focused on how this can improve the lives of learners with disabilities, how it can increase access and opportunity, accessibility in curriculum and in schools in general. And so that's kind of what my lens is when as I've been listening and hopefully our conversation. We have had discussions on this podcast about AI and the implications of how it affects learners with disabilities. So I'm wondering if you could just set the table here and whoever wants to go first, like what's like the big idea you want people to know about what you've learned about how AI has impacted education?
There's a couple things I could say to start. And so if we're talking about education broadly and not these domains of accessibility and learners with disability, I think the one big idea is that AI has not been unambiguously good. It has raised challenges and complications. And that's not to say that there aren't promising potential affordances of AI, and particularly, I think, in the domain of accessibility and helping learners with disabilities. I think those are domains in which there's probably reason to be optimistic about AI's capabilities as we come to understand what it's capable of doing more and more. But to me, the one big idea is this has been something that has been challenging for schools and for teachers and for students to make sense of and to figure out.
I'd say from one place we could start is with methods. So a thing that we believe really strongly is that when there are interesting and important challenges in education, the first thing to do is listen very closely to the people who are closest to those challenges. So if you're a school leader, if you're a district leader, heaven forbid you work in a state or a nonprofit or something like that, your day-to-day is probably pretty far removed from what's actually happening in classrooms. And that is the place where our attention should turn first, to really listen to students and teachers and tell us what's happening, what's going on, what are you seeing, what are you doing, how are you experiencing this? I think we often try to design schools for the way that we wish people learned rather than the way they actually learned, for the way that we wish schools operated rather than the way they actually operate. So there's a method thing that's in there, and it's connected to a belief that it's likely that a lot of the good ideas for the best possible applications or the most important constraints and restrictions on GPTs are going to come from the discoveries, the experimentation of practicing educators and students who can tell us a lot about when they're learning, when they're not, what they're seeing, what works for them, what doesn't work for them. You know, they don't always make good decisions, but a lot of times they can tell you a lot about what they're thinking as they're making bad decisions.
Yeah, as I have been listening to these episodes, I don't know if this is like an imperfect comparison, right? But when the internet and search happened, you know, in the late 90s, I was working at a university library, and like my job was supposed to help people find research, you know, like, and we had like these search engine type of things, right? That were specifically for research articles.
But like then WorldCat and
LexisNexis. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. I was there, man.
And then all of a sudden, you know, my boss is like, yeah, so there's this thing called Google that people are using. And I was just like, what is happening, you know? And like, it completely changed everything. And I feel like the GPTs, the chat, you know, features, we're at this another moment of it's completely changing everything, and there's no going back and stuff like that. So and what I'm hearing from the people that you're talking to in this the series is the institutions, the schools, they just don't know, like, they don't know what they don't know. So they don't actually have any sort of guidance, you know, on that. So it leaves a lot of teachers to be like, it's the wild, wild west, and I'm just going to do what I'm going to do. You know, I'm either going to be really, really strict and hard and ban everything, or I'm going to, you know, be lenient and kind of take in consideration the situation. But like, no one is telling anyone what to do. And I'm wondering maybe if you could expound on that.
Yeah, this is something that I and Jesse have been thinking a lot about. It's really important to start with the idea that no one knows what to do. You have plucked upon one of my favorite historical examples, which is the arrival of the web. Because I was teaching kids in a high school history classroom how to, you know, do historical work on the web in 2003. And a really important part of that story is you were showing people how to do stuff in the late 90s. I was showing how to do stuff in 2003, the first peer-reviewed publication that showed verified, demonstrably, provably good ways to teach people how to search the web was published in 2019. That is a big gap. That's a 20-year gap. Not only that, but you probably remember that quite a bit of the stuff that we taught, that experts came up with in the late 90s and the early 2000s, later proved to be totally wrong, was not just benignly bad, but I think really harmful to the development of a generation of young people's abilities to search the web, and probably detrimental to our democracy. So we taught people the crap test and these checklist methods, and .org and .edu are more trustworthy than .com, and don't use Wikipedia. So all these shibboleths that if you go back and you read the people at the time who are coming up with these things, they seem awfully sensible, and they're actually able to create these sort of worldviews that say, well, here's the first principles that inform this, and here's a little bit of like evidence that I'm getting of people telling me it is working and seeing it's working. They, you know, a whole group of people convinced themselves that they had a good approach. And then we had enough research over time to go, whoa, no. When people apply these methods in real world search context, they do very poorly, like troublingly poorly, and much worse than people who use alternative methods. So I, to me, that is a real summons for humility. There's a real summons in this moment to say, we don't want to do that again. What we want to do, in particular, I think everyone should be suspicious of anybody who's racing to be first. Anyone who's racing to have, here's the first set of methods, here's the first framework, here's the first acronym, here's the, like, we don't want to be first. We want to be right. We want to be really attentive to people who are doing high quality research. And we can actually look back at what are the things we did well and made mistakes with the web, with social media, with mobile phones? And can we apply some of the best of those techniques of building a field to the challenges that we have now? So you'll probably hear Jesse and I sort of bring a lot of humility to these questions. And then I'm compelled by my own past mistakes and errors to push back about one thing you said, which is that none of this is inevitable. OpenAI and Anthropic and DeepSeek would like us to believe this is inevitable. It's not inevitable. The technologies that we choose to bring into schools are our choices. And if they harm learning, we fight them. If they harm learning, we fight. If they're good, we bring them in, we figure out how to make them fit. And we are fortunate to have these generative AI tools showing up in a moment in which educators all around the world are going, remember how we said mobile phones were inevitable and you could never put the toothpaste back in the tube and we just have to accept them because they're part of kids' futures? Actually, maybe we don't. Maybe there's some really good reasons to ban them from schools, because for all the learning potential they may have, they have a whole other set of characteristics that makes them unsuitable for creating learning environments in which people develop to their full potential and develop social skills that we think are important, all those kinds of things. If that's what we discover about generative AI tools in 3 years and 5 years and 7 years, then we need to not describe them as inevitable. We need to describe them as like under probationary arrival into our schools. And if they're bad, we fire them.
Jesse, I have a question for you. It has to do with what your observation was of teachers being willing to talk about this. You said you had a lot of teachers, you interviewed a lot of teachers. So I'm wondering, like, is this one of the top, like, things that are on teachers' minds currently, as you've been talking to teachers? Is this like the thing that is filling up their
top of the list?
Top of the list, right?
Not always, often maybe it's in the top five things that they're thinking about right now, but also, you know, we emerged from the pandemic, and so teachers are thinking, have my students re-socialized, you know, particularly since our reporting is going back to the fall of 2022, which is shortly after the pandemic. So, you know, have they figured out how to, you know, play together at recess and work in groups when I put them in groups? Many schools are dealing with absenteeism, chronic absenteeism right now. There is the perpetual struggle with burnout and with funding and personnel issues. You know, a lot of teachers are thinking like, how am I going to plan? Because I told my friend that I'm going to, you know, cover their sixth period because they're sick and I'm not going to have my planning period. You know, they're thinking about things like that. So AI tends to be in there. And I think probably teachers who have a lot of stressors right now and are struggling with a lot of things, the first thing they're going to be thinking about is cheating, because that's the most urgent concern around AI. You know, you put out fires before you start figuring out how can I use this tool, you know, for good. I don't know that I talked to any teacher who said this is the biggest concern. Maybe there were a few, but many of them described it as, wow, there's a lot that's challenging me right now. There are a lot of things that are making my job difficult and challenging right now. And right now, AI and figuring out what to do about generative AI just feels like one of them.
And Jesse, would you say that your sense was that in schools with fewer resources, that in schools that were serving students with more needs and more challenges, it was more common for them to say that AI was lower down the list because these other urgent things, chronic absenteeism,
yes,
getting enough resources are higher on the list?
Yes. I mean, there might be the occasional exception to that, but yes, on the whole, schools that had better resources and schools that served better resourced students and better resourced populations, more higher socioeconomic populations, there tended to be more breathing room. There tended to be more space, and that meant there tended to be more time to have conversations about AI. And often there would be somebody in the building who kind of made it their job to think about AI, you know, and how do we manage the challenges around academic integrity? And also, how do we start thinking about some of the possible benefits and ways in which this technology can be useful? You know, there are schools that had people like that, and they tended to be more affluent schools.
I'd imagine it's going to continue to be challenging, because just like, you know, any local school district can essentially make decisions about what they do, right? With curriculum, you know, a school district and school board decides how they run the school and what the things that they teach and even with state standards and all that, right? So potentially you could have two schools in the same county of a state that handle AI differently. So you have, you know, school district A that allows it, but with certain parameters, and then you have school district B that completely bans it. So what are the conversations? I don't know if you have interviewed administrators or like superintendents, and like what is their thinking about how they're tackling this problem or issue, I guess?
Not as many administrators, a handful. And part of that is that it's been hard to get calls back when you call the superintendent's office.
Sure.
Often, yeah. Because in many times they're dealing with what feels like probably a more urgent challenge, you know, maybe around funding or maybe around chronic absenteeism or something like that. But I would say, you know, to your point, it's not just that one school or one district in a state might have a completely different attitude and approach to AI. You could have two teachers in the same building with a different attitude and approach to AI. And in many cases, I mean, we did a survey partnered with RAND, the results are coming out pretty soon, where we asked teachers if they had gotten any kind of updated policy guidance from their district or from their school. And only one quarter of teachers said they had. We asked the same question about professional development. Again, only one quarter said that they had. This was in the fall of 2024, so about a year ago. My sense is that some of the districts have caught up, but in many cases, the school districts just aren't really thinking about it. Or at least when we started doing our reporting, you know, in 2023, 2024, they weren't really thinking about it. And maybe now many of them are starting to catch up. Although I still think if you were to do that survey again, I suspect you'd find a shockingly large number of districts haven't really convened any professional development. They haven't, you know, they haven't had meetings with their curriculum people and the department heads at their various schools. They haven't updated their academic integrity guidance around AI. I think there's still quite a bit of lagging in having those conversations.
I really like that question about what are pathways that schools could take with new technology. And I think it's helpful to, again, put it in historical context. There are some technologies that have proven to be durable, and probably schools are glad that they have invested over the years in bringing the web into the schools and showing kids that use the web. There have been other technologies. You know, there are probably a whole bunch of schools that are really glad they never invested in smart boards. that every school that didn't buy a smart board is probably like, yep, saved a bunch of money, didn't waste a lot of time there. You could imagine that a thing that we learn in the future is that getting GPTs to spit out text is actually relatively easy. Just doesn't take a lot of specialized training. I don't know, maybe we eventually come up with some good acronyms for things you're supposed to do or a couple of good techniques or things like that. But what if we found out that actually prompting, not that hard, but discerning the quality of output is really, really hard. That a really unfortunate thing about GPTs is because of the probabilistic models underneath them, even on very similar tasks. Sometimes they have really good, useful, meaningful, relevant output, and sometimes they have lousy, crummy, inaccurate, hallucinated, false output, both of which are presented with equal levels of confidence. And it could be that the main thing that you need to discern between good output and not good output is domain expertise. And the heart of domain expertise actually is knowledge. That the main thing that you need, if you're asking GPT to give you a bunch of advice about how to plumb a new building or how to fix a plumbing problem, is to know a bunch of stuff about plumbing. To know whether it's telling you something that makes sense about plumbing or is a terrible, terrible, dangerous, flood-worthy idea in plumbing. And there's no acronym, there's no like AI literacy that will help you with that. It's domain knowledge. Now, the good thing about that story is that the one thing that schools in this country have tried to do for the past couple hundred, 300 years is try to teach kids domain knowledge. So it could be actually the most important thing to do to prepare people for an AI future is not anything related to AI literacy. It's just helping them be well-rounded, smart individuals. The story I've just told you could also not be true. It could be that actually we determine that there are some domains, that there are certain kinds of techniques or skills which can help you figure out what problems are amenable to AI, what are not, how to use them more effectively, how to not. But from the outset, I don't think we could say confidently that a school that goes all in on AI is going to prepare students better for their future than a school that says, no, we're going to go all in on the things that we're already really good at. We're going to invest the bulk of our time in places where we already have investments because the best way we can prepare kids for the future is teaching them a bunch of stuff and doing the things that we already know how to do well. And there's good reasons to believe from the last 20 years of sort of technology literacy efforts that actually school systems are really, as much as I love them, as much appreciation as I have for all the educators, they're not that good at this. If you look at the technology skills that our students have graduated with, you watch a kid endlessly scrolling on their phone, and we're not that great at social media literacy. You look at the research outcomes on students searching the web, and we've totally failed that in important ways. If you've ever asked a recent graduate to save a file to a folder, then you know that they're not particularly good at, sort of whatever productivity software, understanding fundamental computing architecture. It's just the school systems, as of 1980, like the curriculum was pretty packed. There's no school system that I know that said, oh, you don't have to do French anymore. You don't have to do art anymore. You don't have to do world history anymore because we're going to place that with computers. They've all said, we're going to wedge computers. I mean, you know, this is your work as a librarian. We're going to wedge web literacy into this like 37 minutes that the librarian has with the fourth grade twice a year. That doesn't work. Quite possibly we're going to try to do with AI literacy similarly will not work.
What does going all in on AI really mean anyway?
Coming up after the break, we dig into how uneven the rollout of AI has been in schools and why teachers in different contexts are feeling its impact in different ways. Justin and Jesse talk about what they're hearing from classrooms, the gaps in guidance, and how educators are trying to navigate the wild west of new tools while still focusing on what helps students learn. But first, a word from our sponsor. This episode is sponsored by Adaptiverse. If you're a special education teacher, you already know the time problem. Every week, educators spend 15 to 20 hours manually adapting curriculum, especially for students with complex communication needs. We're talking about non-speaking learners, AAC users, students with apraxia, or language-based disabilities. Creating personalized materials, building visual supports, designing multiple expressive pathways for the same lesson, it's critical work, but it's exhausting, and it pulls teachers away from actually teaching. Adaptiverse changes that. Teachers simply describe what they're teaching and who they're teaching, and the platform generates grade-level academic lessons, personalized to each student's needs, with built-in scaffolding and multiple ways to demonstrate understanding. And these aren't watered-down worksheets. These are rigorous lessons that presume competence and increase engagement through personalization. Adaptiverse is built on 60-plus years of combined education experience and is already being used to create more than 2,000 lessons in 35 states, with educators calling it life-saving and irreplaceable. If you're ready to get those hours back and focus on what matters most, visit adaptiverseapp.com to learn more. That's adaptiverseapp.com to learn more.
With, you know, like, okay, like how and with what? And are you going to, like, are you focusing on, you know, a particular chatbot, or are you talking about a customized agent that is, you know, specifically designed for a particular purpose? The most exciting things that that I've come across are organizations that are customizing the power of this generative AI for a specific purpose. And I'll give you an example. There's an organization in Maryland called Adaptiverse, and they're focusing on helping teachers modify lessons that, you know, if you are, you have a social studies lesson, it's a middle school lesson, that lesson, like out of the curriculum box, right, is probably not attuned to certain types of learners. Mm-hmm. And so this chatbot will take that lesson and the profile of the learner and make it so that it is more accessible for that learner. And there's a lot of different applications, you know, but I'm thinking of this one in particular. I think that is very, very useful, right? But it's specific, right? Or you can, I don't have a specific example, but just more of a, wouldn't this be cool? And I know that like teachers are doing it, is they are learning better instructional techniques by taking a lesson that is off the shelf or, you know, from Teachers Pay Teachers, and then having the GPT rearrange the lesson so it is more either engaging or it has, you know, different like evidence-based practices built into the lesson. So it's like enhancing the lesson, stuff like that. I think that is like the most exciting for the application of the teachers. Is that, have you heard anything about that?
Yeah, I think the kinds of use cases and examples that you're describing are among the most exciting stories and anecdotes that we've heard. And actually, you know, five episodes, as of this taping, we've put up four episodes. We have three more coming, and the next two are going to be full of stories like the ones that you're describing. And in some cases, it is ed tech that has been built around artificial intelligence, you know, maybe built around like the ChatGPT API or something like that, where the technology designers have developed modules to do the exact sort of things that you're talking about. Or it might be a particularly creative and energetic teacher who enjoys experimenting with ChatGPT. In an upcoming episode, there's a teacher named Eric Timmons. I would say he's one of two or three teachers who told me unambiguously AI has been great for his practice, is saving him time, is giving him new ideas, is something he exposes to his students. He teaches film in Santa Ana, California, in Orange County. And he, majority of his students are Latino. Majority are qualify for free or reduced lunch. They make movies, and he has them from 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade. And he wanted culturally responsive text for his students. So he found a pretty, you know, intense, I think, academic article on gentrification in Santa Ana. And he had his students read it. And then he's a fan of PBL Works and Project Zero. And he asked ChatGPT essentially to design some in-class activities that would be follow-up discussions, bridge activities based on those curriculum designers for his students. And then, you know, ChatGPT does that in 1 or 2 minutes. And then as a veteran teacher who's been doing this kind of teaching practice for, at least a decade, I think, he's then able to take what it gives him and shape it based on his own experience, based on his own expertise, and also based on his own knowledge of his specific students and what they're interested in and how to engage. And I think Justin likes to point this out. When we hear stories of teachers using these kinds of, we've had lots of teachers tell us if they're talking about downsides and upsides of ChatGPT or other AI, downside is almost always academic integrity challenges, cheating, there might be privacy, cyberbullying, that sort of thing, where most teachers have said they're already finding some benefit if they're using it in this way is differentiation of tests, of differentiation of texts or adapting pre-existing curriculum. But I think, you know, Justin would point out, and maybe I should just let Justin do it, that often the teachers who are doing this effectively or purport to be doing it effectively, they could probably do what they're getting the AI to do on their own. The AI is just doing it more quickly, and it's doing it with a lot of supervision from the teacher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that they have a certain degree of expertise. They can discern, GPT made a good modification of this lesson, or it did a good job turning this article into a Project Zero thinking routine. Whereas a novice teacher will just trust the output, conceivably would just trust the output of a GPT, even when it's bad, even when it doesn't create a good lesson. I often think one of the most striking teacher learning experiences I had was visiting High Tech High, which maybe some of your listeners know. It's a project-based learning school in Southern California. And I was visiting it when it was, 15 years underway or something like that. But the original art teacher was still there. Their school is sort of all about projects. And he clearly had many, many thousands of educators wander through his classroom, look at what's going on. And there was a moment when we were going back and forth when he stopped and had this kind of eyes turn red, sort of, there were like flames erupting from behind them, sort of gathered all of us and was like, do the project. That the most important thing that you can do to make effective project-based learning environments in your classrooms is for you to do the project before you make the kids do the project. Mm-hmm. There's a craftsmanship that sort of is underneath there that says, you don't know that you have a good project until you have actually created the outputs yourself. And it reminds me that like that act of tinkering with curriculum, that act of modifying document, like that's part of the learning and preparing process for teachers. If the machine just spits out some things that you're supposed to do, you might be able to look at those, like an expert will be able to look at those things. Those are good things. Those are bad things. I'm just going to pick the good things. A novice has no idea. But both the expert and the novice, when they're coming up with things, are like, oh, you know, I really do believe that actually the most important thing when I'm teaching about ancient Athens, this is for my own history as a teacher, is that we're really having a discussion about the merits of aristocracy versus meritocracy. That's like actually really what the heart, you know, and I didn't know that when I started teaching ancient Athens. I knew it after I had taught and designed a bunch of lessons and read a bunch of materials, read things along with my students. Like, you're figuring this out as things are going along. And so to some extent, it could be that machines that bypass that, you know, I mean, I think we're all pretty confident that machines that bypass thinking for students is bad. Machines that bypass thinking for teachers may also be bad. I also think that for any of these questions, we can start with the research that we already have. There are lots of reasons why teachers feel like they have to go to teachers pay teachers, but we know that when teachers grab random supplemental resources off the internet, then they're grabbing things that are poorly aligned with standards, that are not well designed, that don't seem to have a good, they don't have a good trajectory of supporting students' learning. In contrast to either departments that are selecting high quality curriculum and using them together, or groups of teachers in some sort of less formal capacity. You know, you don't have to select the best thing that Pearson, whoever, illustrative math, whoever published. You could come together and build a good thing yourself, but it's usually built with like some expertise in pedagogy, some expertise in subject material. If you're using AI to take really good materials and do some differentiation to serve different audiences or to do, you know, I love the way, you know, I think the way you framed it for him with Tim, which is actually different than other people, was how do I pressure test this curriculum? You know, unfortunately, to me, that's a much more compelling framing than how do I churn this stuff out as quickly as possible? Mm-hmm. It seemed, you know, from the research we have, if we're going to make guesses, I would definitely bet on pressure testing high quality curriculum and making refinements than I would, you know, making some garbage from teachers, paid teachers, slightly less garbage or something like that. So there's a lot that we already know about how really good education systems work, that can help us make good bets and do, you know, promising experiments with GPTs.
Now I'm looking up the adjectival form of garbage.
Yes. Well, I'm sure.
Good creative writing. Garbagey, I think.
Garbagerous.
Garbageois. It's from the French.
So like there is no real shortcut like to being a good teacher, just like there isn't a shortcut to being a good student. You know, in all the examples that I've heard so far in the homework machine, students, you know, for whatever reason, they make a decision to use AI to finish a project, homework, write a paper, and they all have different reasons. But that in and of itself, like, doesn't actually, they haven't learned anything. And they may have checked something off of their list to do, but it doesn't make them a better student. Just as a teacher, you know, who should be a craft, should be a master of their craft of designing a lesson, of creating a lesson plan, of going through curriculum, deciding, you know, what to include or not include, how they differentiate for a particular student. You know, all that is skill, and there's no shortcut even if you use a GPT to do that for you.
Yeah, I would say there are probably no shortcuts to being a good teacher. There may be administrative tasks that are not worth the time and energy that teachers put into them that perhaps ChatGPT or other AI can help with. I've had teachers tell me that they're using ChatGPT to draft letters or emails to parents, or to draft self-evaluations. There's some teachers who nervously talk about maybe using ChatGPT to help them offer kind of mid-project feedback to students, I think is the term formative assessment, that sort of thing. That, I mean, that also raises the question, though, to me, if a tool that is really good at generating formulaic writing is what you need to get something done, was it a valuable task in the first place? You know, if the self-evaluation process is designed in such a way that you can, that ChatGPT can do an effective version of it, is it really a valuable self-evaluation process? I don't know. But I do think that that teachers do say that there are some, you know, you got to do them administrative tasks that they might be able to find, you know, assistance from AI, for which they might be able to find assistance from AI.
But I do think we should generally be cautious of efficiency arguments. I was actually standing around my kitchen today being like, efficiency arguments, man, like these people have played us for like a century. Like, oh, you've got vacuum cleaners and dishwashers and laundry machines, and now it's going to be super easy to keep your house clean. And say like, no, it's not. Like, it's still a lot of work to do all these things because you like just, I mean, you know, the historians of science and the sociologists of work can tell us all about how efficiency gains make us keep buying these machines, but then we get held to higher or different standards or something like that. And then actually education has some ready examples of things that we thought were going to make our lives more efficient that ended up doing something really different. Like the Scantron machine made grading really efficient. I don't think there are a lot of educators today who are like, man, I am so glad the Scantron machine made multiple choice such a central part of our education system. Like, that's really making learning better. I'm really able to like spend my time on the most important things because of the Scantron machine. You know, another great example to me, and really a more frightening example in some ways, are online grade books. I went to my daughter's middle school first day a couple of years ago, and pretty much the entire like parents' night, there was like 2 minutes of this is what we're going to teach in each little mini class, and then like 17 minutes of here's how to go into PowerSchool, here's how to go into Google Classroom, here's how to look at kids' grades, here, like, these zeros don't count, but these zeros do count, and if you see this kind of zero, it means you should probably give me a call and figure out what's going on. I was just so bummed that, like, what I really wanted was 20 minutes of them telling me what books they were going to read and what the poetry was like and what their approach was and how they do math and, you know, and then, you know, and like maybe their phone number in case something goes off the rails or something like that. And so online grade books were sold to schools. Schools bought them saying, oh, this is going to make the process of recording and reporting grades more efficient. And instead, what we got is in a lot of schools, we have basically replaced our parent-teacher communication systems with these online, you know, we've created this system where like, well, what we'd like you to do is like surveil your have the capacity to surveil your students' grades daily, and get in touch with teachers when something in that data prompts you to do so. And I think most people think that's a terrible system for most kids. It could be, and, you know, in some cases, actually, it's probably pretty helpful for some kids. But in a lot of cases, it's a disaster. And, you know, and not only is it bad, but I think if you went to any school, you know, 13,000 school districts in the United States, I think if you went to any of them and said, when you bought online grade books, were you trying to change parent-teacher communication? They'd be like, no, definitely not. That is not why we bought this thing. But they did. And so I think a lot with GPTs and in the domains in which you're claiming to be more efficient, in what ways might we actually just end up doing something different? And why might different be bad? I mean, one good thing about educators is I think that we have, you know, there's certain, you know, we have an appreciation for efficiency and elegance, but also most educators have a certain skepticism of efficiency because we know that like a worksheet that a kid can dash their way through really, really quickly is probably not as good as a learning experience that has some productive struggle, that has some friction, that has some places that are really prompting thinking rather than, you know, prompting struggle rather than prompting smoothness.
Well, and just to be clear, Justin, are you saying that teachers and school leaders should not be experimenting with AI systems to see if they can find accessibility gains or efficiency gains or automating tasks that might scan as a waste of time so that they can spend more time, you know, building relationships with their students or on the tasks that they know do support learning?
I do think they should not believe that that would be the outcome. I think you go to any teacher who's been in the classroom for the last 20 years who has seen a remarkable change in the technology infrastructure of their schools. Go knock on the door of 10, 20 year veterans and say, can you spend more time on the most important parts of teaching? because of all the technology that's in your building. And I don't think you will find many 20-year veterans who are like, yeah, this is the most efficient I've ever been in my career. The machines handle all the boring stuff and I spend my time doing the most important things. Maybe some people will say that, but Tim's shaking his head.
I'm just remembering how many times I had to, I had to fight with the smart board or the Promethean board or the technology in the middle of a lesson because it wasn't working, right?
Yeah. The GPT, and you're getting, I was at a funeral the other day and was talking to a friend of mine and the teacher was like, yeah, I had GPT make some quizzes, but they had stuff that was wrong on them. Actually, there's a joke in software engineering, which is for every hour you save coding with a Copilot, it'll cost you an hour in quality assurance down the line. That basically the time that you save writing code faster, you pay for by fixing the errors that you've introduced from lousy code. Right. And that's, the sort of quiz example is kind of a classic one.
A 30-second podcast ad about AI-powered edtech. This podcast brought to you by
Magic Brit. School, by School AI. Yeah. Justin and Jesse say, don't waste your money on this garbage. No, experiment with this garbage. But
I won't tell you who our sponsor is for this podcast. So,
actually, a thing that I've been saying over and over again is like, I've taken money from every technology company that you can think, just Google and Microsoft and CZI.
Google is supporting our research right now. And actually, our contact there is really interested in what we're learning and what he called the sort of the socio-technical dimension of the technology that they spend, so much of their time focusing on.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So one more question about, and this is for Justin. And then I do want to get into the weeds just a little bit about the podcast production side of it, because Ariel worked with you, right?
Yep.
Ariel Nissenblatt. And yep. Ariel and I go way back. We produced a podcast together called Trailer Park.
I'm a fan of Trailer Park, the podcast.
Okay. Good.
I was living in a trailer that looks like the trailer on the Trailer Park podcast cover.
Really?
When you launched that podcast. I did about 9 months in a camper trailer before settling in Los Angeles.
That's wild.
I was a Trailer Park fan in a trailer.
You're one of the OG trailers. Trailies? Trailers? Trailer Parkers?
I don't know. Those. I mean, I don't know. I don't know. Again,
one of those.
Look up the noun form.
Okay, so Justin, How have you AI proofed how you are working with students or have you?
Dang, I haven't. That's what I have to do this week. My first class is on Wednesday. Jesse and I actually right after this are going to record a little segment. I'm thinking about it. I'm struggling with it a lot. I have some assignments that took me 20 years worth of practice to kind of web proof. Like I have a bunch of assignments that you cannot answer with a Google search. And GPT does an okay job. I'll tell you about one of them. I teach a class called Learning Media and Technology, in which I have students take a piece of education technology, identify whether it's more inspired by kind of direct instruction or like constructionism, apprenticeship kind of thing. If it's more of a like Dewey sort of thing, more of a Thorndike sort of thing. And they have to explain why. And then they have to reimagine the technology as built by the other folks. So you say like Scratch is really more of a like Dewey constructionist kind of thing. What would it be like if the like direct instruction people had designed it? A great assignment. Mm-hmm. You've got to like take a thing, you've got to map it onto these two schema. You have to flip it into the other schema. You can't do a Google search for it. And GPT does an okay job. A thing I did last year was just ask my students, like, what should I do with GPT? And they were like, we're not going to use it. Your class is a lot harder than the other electives we could have taken. And like, if we just wanted to blast through, we would have taken something else. And I was like, oh, you flattered me, students. Go on then. You know, I was just like,
they saw you coming.
Go on.
Perfect. Yes. I was just like, oh, the perfect way to like get me out of it. What I'm doing this year though, is, there's good kind of scientific inquiry about whether recognition can be, how does recognition compare with generation as a learning activity? So what I'm going to do is not have students write that essay. I'm going to have them write 10 of those essays quickly. I'm going to say, go to GPT and come up with 10 versions. Let GPT do 10 versions of this exercise, read across them. This is something that I couldn't have had you do before. I couldn't have had you do this exercise 10 times. It takes too long, but the machine can do it 10 times. And so then we're going to see what you learn by looking across 10 of these machine made examples, and you'll pick one of them and refine it. So I'm going to introduce that to them next Wednesday. In about a month, I'm going to test that assignment. We'll see how it goes.
So let me ask a question about the 10. So are you going to have them do like 10 discrete prompts, or are you going to have GPT say,
ask GPT 10 times, pick a technology, compare it to these two frameworks, take the technology, design it. Basically have GPT write the essay, but have it write the essay for 10 different technologies quickly.
Gotcha.
Read across these 10 fast drafts you came up with, and then pick one of them to refine. I'm going to ask my students, like, what do you think? This is what I'm going to try. What do you think of this assignment? Do you think we should do it? I'll probably encourage them to do it this way, because I introduced this last year, and the students were like, nah, we'll just write the essay. I also teach a class called Introduction to Media Studies, where a thing that me and my colleagues have done for decades is to have people not use media for a day. For this generation of students, it's a very powerful, unique experience for them to like not use their phone for a day, not use computer screens for a day, and stuff like that. And for that essay, I'm going to do the thing which everyone tells you is no longer possible, and just tell them not to use ChatGPT. I'm going to have to do some work on the front end to convince them that this is really a rich learning experience that they will learn from the most. But the other thing I've been thinking a lot about is I've spent 20 years teaching kids to write better, and I'm really certain I can help you do better. And I'm almost positive that you doing the work yourself is absolutely essential to me helping you do better. And that if you use this crutch, I don't know that I can help you anymore. I know I can help you if you do it the way that I'm used to. I don't know that I can help you this other way. So those are kind of two examples. One of which, none of them are AI proof. And one is like, all right, well, if we're going to do this, let's go all in. And the other one is like pleading, coming up with the right context to plead with students. Just like your second grade teacher told you not to use a calculator when you were doing that math worksheet, I'm telling you not to use ChatGPT now, because just like memorizing your multiplication tables really matters, writing things yourself really matters. And then who knows what students will do.
If I might tie Justin's answer back to the Homework Machine podcast too, in episode 3, we talk about 3 strategies that teachers use to try to keep their students from using AI to bypass learning. Justin has kind of suggested a 4th one here, which is also something we've heard from a few teachers. So Justin is doing a version of what we're calling version 1, monitor and communicate, which we could also just call like plead with your students. Like
plead. This is what it feels like right now.
This is why I think it's important that you don't use AI to do this particular assignment. It's because I want you to learn. We have one teacher, Maria, talking about students' dendrite connections failing. And in some cases, teachers believe that their relationships with their students are so strong that pleading may just work, right? Or that their students value learning, or that it's a combination of some of that pleading plus, and I'll be watching you and you'll get in trouble if you do. Like a little bit of that pleading. There's the classic right now, many teachers are relying on detection, Turnitin, other detection software, or their own kind of hacked detection where they, put invisible tiny font text into the prompt, and that causes the AI to spit out something kind of funny. A lot of people are AI proofing with pencil and paper, pen and paper, composition notebooks, or, you're going to do this assignment in class and I'm going to watch you do it. I'm going to watch you handwrite it. And that can work pretty well. But of course, it's not ideal for all assignments. It's not ideal for projects. It's not ideal for assignments that, the teacher wants the students to do at home. And then Justin just articulated a 4th, which I guess we could call like lean in, right? Go all in. Out AI the students. All right. You want to use AI? Now you really have to use AI.
Use it 10 times.
You're going to use it until you hate it.
Exactly. It's like, oh, you want to eat Jello for dessert? Fine.
Oh, it's the Bogtrotter.
You want to eat Jello for breakfast?
It's Bruce Bogtrotter from Matilda, who eats a bite of the Trunchbull's cake and has to
Eat the whole thing. Oh my gosh! Yes, exactly.
I'm going full Bogtrotter on my students. I love it.
I mean, but there are some teachers who have interesting experiments in this zone, where they are encouraging their students to use AI in sort of experimental ways, and then getting their students to evaluate the output and making that evaluation and that kind of iterative process part of the project or part of the graded assignment in the school. And that, I mean, that certainly seems interesting. I'll be interested to ask Justin how it goes.
Well, The Homework Machine, every single episode I've listened to, has been fantastic. I encourage everyone to listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And this is a 7-part limited series. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes.
And then
we may have some bonuses. Okay. And, you know, it was brought about by some very generous funding by specific funders who you can hear in the credits. And, you know, if we're able to convince more funders or the same funders that a second season would be a good idea, we'd be excited to do that. We've also talked about maybe, you know, the second season is the distraction machine, all about mobile phone bans and restrictions and how that's playing out in schools. I think that would be a fun season. Justin and I probably have an overdue conversation about what we do next after The Homework Machine. But right now we're still in the midst of production, and that's about all I can think about. I got to edit for episode 5 coming up pretty soon. I gotta crank on that in just a few minutes here.
I love it. We are right up at the top of the hour. Can you stay a little bit longer?
I can. I can do another 5 or 10 minutes. Yeah.
Okay. Great. So one podcast related question, just kind of the process, because the storytelling is really compelling. Sound and sound design and the music is wonderful. Justin, you were saying that the harpsichord is like a literal
harpsichord. The harpsichord is a real harpsichord from the MIT Music and Theater Department.
That
somewhere
is,
there's an email chain that's like, Justin, Justin, do you know where I could get a harpsichord for one day when I'm in Boston or Cambridge? And Justin, in fact, I believe Elsa, Justin's wife, came up with the harpsichord connect, if I remember.
I think I knew enough to go to music theater, the music department. But
Here's me not realizing that MIT had a music and theater department. So.
It's actually really good. We just built a giant new building. Just about every enormous number of kids play instruments, which probably doesn't surprise you that kids who are both nerdy on machines and other science things also like violins and pianos and guitars. And
yeah.
What is a musical instrument but a technology for
beaten by their parents? Part of why I knew that they would be very likely to have it is that I used to teach on the floor where a bunch of the practice instruments were. I had a classroom that was kind of across the way from this like hallway full of semi soundproof practice pianos, and you'd like walk by and hear sort of beautiful music on your way into class to lecture kids about MOOCs or something like that.
And when I was a kid in Charlottesville, Virginia, before my dad went back to grad school and eventually got a PhD, his job prior to that was that he was a piano tuner, and he would often tune the piano, and I think a harpsichord as well, for the University of Virginia's music department. And so I was aware that I knew that there would be kind of an infrastructure around potentially a harpsichord at a university too. We guessed and we were correct.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. And I'm wondering, is this the choice to make this a narrative series? Had this been just kind of a dream of y'all's, like, I really want to tell the story and we're going to tell it this way? Or how did that come about, the choice to make this a narrative series?
I can take a stab at that, and Justin, you can tell me if you agree with this historical. So Justin brought me in when I was a freelancer. Well, we've done some other work together before. And when the Teach Lab podcast started, I was a consultant. I was working full time at WBEZ then, but I helped Justin and his team with some production tasks and also kind of ideation, thinking through the different formats editing they could use.
Yeah.
Some early editing, some early, you know, also, yeah, just some early work when they were first starting the Teach Lab podcast, which was mostly an interview driven, sort of two-way interview driven podcast.
Justin and I figured out in late 2023 that it would be interesting to talk to teachers and students about this topic. And we thought, well, maybe we could find some grant funding. And when we did find some, the first grant came from the Spencer Foundation. I always thought these stories are incredible. These are teachers, they're adapting to a disruptive moment. And there's some really wonderful human stories here. It would be great if we could tell a narrative podcast about this and not just do academic publishing or not just do a series of two-way interviews, which can be a great podcasting format. We didn't really have the funding at that point, but we kept applying for grants and we had a pretty good track record. And I think because it was my background and because I had sort of a vision for it, Justin agreeably went along with that once the resources fell into place. And I think also once I shared some of the initial stories from the field, but Justin, does that agree with your sense of the last 2 years?
Yeah, it is funny how, a crucial thing was Jesse helped. We got some money from the office of the president, me and another couple of professors to write, like, what do we think about AI in education? And we decided at that moment to do a few interviews related to them. My colleagues probably happy with it, but I was probably one to push for that. Like, actually, you've got to talk, like, can't just sit here on Mass Ave and tell people what should be happening in school. We should probably talk to them. And that gave us sort of, and then Jesse, Jesse first, like, helped pull together some materials from some interviews we did, and then did some new ones. And then it kind of snowballed from there. But the generous support of the Jameel World Education Lab, Spencer Foundation, MIT's Social and Ethical Response in Computing Initiative, and then eventually a Google Academic Research Award, it was fortunate to be in a moment where if you're an academic coming up with little bits of money to do an AI research project was not as hard as it might be in the future.
And, Justin had a podcast already and I had a background in this kind of podcast production. So, that was already in place.
I mean, the other thing that's already in place is just my research group has very long believed that when things are going on in education, you talk to teachers and students first, that the expertise that's often missing is that which is closest to the problem and the challenge. And in part because I spend a lot of time with policymakers and researchers and stuff like that who are just not closely anchored to what is actually happening, and it makes them less useful.
Thank you for indulging me with that, just behind the scenes a little bit.
We've been talking about how teachers are navigating AI in real time, the trial and error, the experiments, and the very human moments that come with figuring out something new. Before we wrap up, I asked Justin and Jesse a mystery question that takes things in a much more musical direction. Here's how that went.
If I can have you just for one more question, I like to end my interviews with a mystery question. Typically, they are written by my 13-year-old, but I'm fresh out of questions. So I cheated and I asked my friend, Copilot. So I need you to give me somebody, Justin, we'll go with Justin. Give me a number between 1 and 10.
4.
All right. So what is your go-to karaoke? So let me say that one more time. What is your go-to karaoke song, even if you can't sing?
I have more of my walk-on song is...
Okay, I like this too.
...is Rodeo Clowns with G Love and Jack Johnson. Disco ball spinning, all the music and the women and the shots of tequila, and they said that they need you, but what they really need is just a little room to breathe.
Sort of.
Rap.
It has a great drum beat.
Specific.
You time it so you punch through the paper or you hop over the wrestling rings right when the drum beat lands.
My gosh.
And I would carry that. You can also just do nothing compared to you.
What about you, Jesse? Do you have a walk-on song or a karaoke song?
I was thinking I should get a walk-on song. I don't really have one. A few years ago, I won second place at the WBEZ holiday party / talent show karaoke with my rendition of Billy Joel's Piano Man, which is an excellent...
you know, anthemic sing along, you know, people have been drinking a little bit type song, even, you know, even though it's maybe a little bit cheesy, I'll Stand By Piano Man as an excellent karaoke song. And it's in my range. I can just about hit that high note in the chorus. So that's important. I don't think that Nothing Compares to You is in Justin's range, but I don't think that would, that he wouldn't let that stop him if karaoke was on the line.
Well, my wife and I really like to sing Total Eclipse of the Heart.
As a duo.
I used to play music. I used to be in bands and stuff like that. But karaoke was actually not my favorite thing to do. I would much rather hide behind a guitar and, you know, than belt my heart out, my voice. But anyways,
are you in LA? I love karaoke. I mean, I wish that we as a culture just got together and sang more, you know, that's something that doesn't seem to happen as often as it used to. And I think that karaoke gets people doing that. And that's why people love it. Like secretly, we all just want to sort of, you know, be in a group of people and sing along. But there's something about 21st century life that doesn't allow that as often as we'd like to do it. I also was in bands, though, and I probably do enjoy that more than karaoke. But I'm always up for karaoke.
Jesse Dukes and Justin Reich, thank you so much for being on the Think Inclusive podcast. We appreciate it.
This was a fabulous conversation. Thanks for your great questions and giving the homework machine a careful listen. It's a real honor.
Thanks so much, Tim. And we're honored that you took the time to listen to it and to bring us on.
That was Justin Reich and Jesse Dukes. Here's what I'm taking away from this conversation. Educators are still sorting out what AI actually means for day-to-day learning, and how important it is to slow down and listen to the people closest to kids and stay grounded in the core work of teaching. Justin and Jesse reminded us that new tools don't replace good thinking or strong relationships, and that inclusion still comes down to designing environments where every learner can participate and grow. And that's right in line with MCIE's mission, removing barriers, centering learner variability, and making sure students with disabilities are fully included in their neighborhood schools and classrooms. Here's one practical step for educators. Pick one upcoming lesson and run a small experiment. Use an AI tool to draft a few variations of a task or text, and then look at them with a critical eye. Ask yourself, does any version reduce barriers for a student who often gets stuck? The goal isn't to let the AI decide, but to help you notice new possibilities you might refine with your own expertise. Share this episode with a colleague who's building inclusive schools. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Follow Think Inclusive wherever you get your podcasts. Shout out to everyone that attended the Educating All Learners Alliance Community of Action. This last weekend, I had the opportunity to be a coach this time around, and big thanks to Aurora Dreger for leading that event. I hope to be part of it next time. What's on your mind right now? I'd love to hear about it. You can always email me at tviegas@mcie.org. Okay, time for the credits. Think Inclusive is brought to you by me, Tim Viegas. I write, edit, mix, master. I basically wear all the podcast hats and the baseball caps. This show is a proud production of the Maryland Coalition for Inclusive Education, scheduling and extra production help from Jill Wagoner. Our original music is by Miles Kredich with extra vibes from Melody. Big thanks to our sponsor, IXL.com and Adaptiverse. Visit IXL.com/inclusive and AdaptiverseApp.com. Fun fact, over 70% of all images posted on social media are either AI generated or enhanced with AI. Oh, yeah. And that doesn't even include videos, which are even harder and harder to detect if they are authentic. So what does this all mean? I don't know. though it's really hard to believe anything anymore that you see on the internet. How are you feeling about AI? Are you adopting an AI practice in your teaching or in your life? I'd love to know about it. Email me at tviegas@mcie.org. I read every single message. And if you've made it this far, you're officially part of the Think Inclusive Inclusion crew. Want to help us keep moving the needle forward for inclusion?
head to mcie.org and click the donate button. Give $5, $10, $20. It helps us keep partnering with schools and districts to move inclusive practices forward and support educators doing the work. Find us on the socials almost everywhere at Think Inclusive. Thanks for hanging out. And remember, inclusion always works.
From MCIE.
Podcast roll. Welcome in.